You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Palm Springs. The weather's perfect, the patios are packed, and Palm Canyon Drive is full of people. COVID concerns aren't stopping Kimberly Sanders from enjoying a night out. She's visiting from Santa Clarita. Although she's a stickler for pandemic safety protocols after dining al fresco here, she's feeling pretty comfortable.
I'm like the quarantine queen, and I don't go out of the house. They were very, very safe. They made sure that we had our mask on when our waiters served us and, you know, when they refilled our water. I look at it from the standpoint, as long as I have my mask on, I think I'm going to be okay.
Now, Sanders and other tourists who live within driving distance are just what the Palm Springs economy ordered as fall weather sets in. Daytime highs have dropped from 100-plus to the mid-70s. And the hospitality sector is actually doing better than you might think with a pandemic raging. However, it's not all sunshine, as KCRW's Matt Gillum explains.
The lively mood along Palm Canyon Drive this Saturday evening reminds quarantine queen Kimberly Sanders of a
pre-COVID Saturday night. This is not at all what I expected. I expected it to be kind of dead. You know, you had some people eating out or whatever, but like people waiting like this, I was not expecting that.
The busy patios and full sidewalks are evidence that, regardless of the pandemic, people are eager to get out of their homes and spend a few hours, or maybe a weekend, reliving the simple pleasures of a time before coronavirus. The Palm Springs businesses able to capitalize on that need for an escape have adapted to the times. Their pandemic pivots have kept a steady stream of visitors heading here. Take, for instance, the Cole Hotel. Near the entrance to town, along Highway 111, it ticks off all the boxes for your desert escape. Hip mid-century architecture with bright colors, swaying palm trees, and a mellow pool perfect for splashing in or sipping by. A comfortable breeze is blowing as Assistant General Manager Molly Madigan explains the rather unfortunate timing of the hotel's launch.
So the opening went really well. It was kind of a soft opening in February. We did pretty well. We did have, you know, people coming in. It was season for us. It was a great time. Right before that pandemic hit, we had the normal crowds. And then about 2 weeks later, everything shut down.
That's right. Just 2 weeks into the life of the Cole Hotel, hard COVID closures forced it to shutter until June. Madigan says they used that downtime for a months-long strategy session about how to operate in this strange new reality.
It's just been nuts. You know, of course, it's kind of hard, both professionally and personally, to see how much businesses are affected.
In the before times, hospitality meant unique touches and extra personal service. While that spirit remains, in practical terms, it's been turned upside down. Madigan says the hotel goes the extra mile by sparing the touching and limiting interactions.
Everything is virtual, so you get your room information. You can order from the bar and the restaurant directly through a link that we give you. It's a little something that we show that we care about you and what, you know, everything that's going on that you can trust staying here.
Madigan says weekends have been unexpectedly busy, even during the blazing hot summer. The Cole Hotel is gearing up for whatever a busy season in the COVID era looks like, and so are vacation rentals in Palm Springs. They went like gangbusters this summer. In spite of the pandemic, they're bringing in as much money or even more in occupancy taxes compared with last year. That's good news to the city's mayor, Jeff Kors. When the COVID crisis was just taking off, a shortfall of tens of millions of dollars was expected for this fiscal year. Now, the mayor says,
we're thinking we're going to be much less reduced than we thought. So, yes, it's a loss. There's definitely lost revenue when you have this situation. But sales tax has been 80-90% of what it was a year ago. So we're optimistic, but we're not going and spending a lot of the money because we need to see what happens.
The city of 48,000 relies on an economy built on tourism. With not a lot of people flying at the moment and getting in some mid-autumn pool time, the city has shifted its focus to the drive markets, places that can reach the desert by car. The head of the Palm Springs Bureau of Tourism, Rob Hampton, says 2020 has changed what's considered drivable.
People are driving 8, 10, 12 hours now.
Apparently, a roughly 800-mile car ride from Pocatello, Idaho is now totally fair game. And as the city's marketing strategy shifted over the summer to reflect the pandemic, Hampton says the people showing up did too.
Not only were people just coming into town for a vacation, but there was also, you know, that business part where people can work anywhere. A lot more organizations are allowing that, and they're choosing to come to Palm Springs.
That's something Mayor Jeff Kors has noticed also.
With school being virtual, there are a lot of folks who are here with their kids because they could be anywhere. And so a lot of those folks did come to Palm Springs, some just for a weekend, but we're seeing longer rentals too, a week, 2 weeks, even months, because they can be here outside with a pool, with enough bedrooms that they can make an office for one and enjoy great weather and not be nervous or uptight in a smaller place wherever they were living.
These COVID transplants may be filling up the vacation rentals and, by extension, city coffers, but they've had a limited impact on another crucial part of the hospitality sector, restaurants. Lulu became an immediate fixture of downtown Palm Springs almost as soon as it opened in 2011. Serving an eclectic mix of California cuisine spread across multiple menus and offering a C&B scene patio, the cavernous restaurant could seat almost 500 people pre-pandemic. Now, it's made some dramatic changes.
We had a breakfast menu, a lunch menu, a dinner menu, a happy hour menu, another. Name it, we had it. We no longer do breakfast. We used to have a happy hour. We no longer do a happy hour.
John Shea has spent decades in the restaurant business and is the chief operating officer for Lulu. People are brunching on the patio as we sit inside the empty restaurant. The tables are spaced out and there's plexiglass between booths. Shea says they even upgraded the air filtration system. In September, Riverside County entered the red tier of the state's reopening framework. That meant limited indoor dining could resume. Shea was hopeful, but the county's subsequent slip back into the most restrictive purple tier, which prohibits eating inside, poses a threat.
You know, the indoor dining really got us back to a level where we were sustainable. And now we're faced with the challenges again. And, you know, with that indoor closure, we're now looking at potentially cutting hours or reducing staff.
While the safety of the staff and guests is paramount, Shea says he's frustrated with the state's reopening framework for a very simple reason.
Our lives are turned upside down by reacting to what the state's going to do next. You can't plan going forward. I mean, are we going to be open Thanksgiving for indoor dining or are we not?
Shea says the unexpectedly decent summer season the hotels saw passed over his restaurant because, at the time, it was only offering outside dining in the searing Palm Springs heat. But Lulu soldiers on. As the comfortably warm desert fall gets underway, Shea says they're going all in on their upmarket patio.
We've translated the feel of Lulu indoors to the Lulu outdoors, and we actually branded it calling the Lulu Bistro Garden. It's one thing when you say, would you like to sit on the sidewalk or on the street, right? Versus, would you like to sit at the Bistro Garden?
Just like John Shea branding the patio, I mean Bistro Garden, the town of Palm Springs has reinvented itself before. Whether as a golden era Hollywood retreat, a sunny spring break destination, or now as a warm poolside escape from pandemic boredom, the little city tucked against the mountain has always been a place to get away from it all. And, as it turns out, the market for that only seems to be heating up. For KCRW, I'm Matt Gillum.
Gotta get my luggage packed. Leaving town and won't be back. Jump, jive, dance, and swing. Everybody's jumping down in Palm Springs. If you have a buck or two, tell you what you gotta do. Go watch the yuppies swing. Everybody's jumping down in Palm Springs. While the snow is falling on the mountaintop.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis, and now to the election and one big race that's been called for the Los Angeles County District Attorney, which pitted incumbent Jackie Lacey against former San Francisco DA George Gascon. He's been hailed by the left as a progressive, an advocate for criminal justice reform, and after a summer of protests and calls for justice in the killings of black people at the hands of police and sheriff's deputies, an intense year, an intense campaign, and George Gascon, the incoming LA County District Attorney, is here with me right now. Mr. Gascon, welcome and congratulations. Hey.
Thank you, Steve. Really appreciate it. How are you?
I'm all right. As I mentioned, you carried a more progressive game plan, including advocating for police reform. Now, that's something that's been top of mind for many Angelenos who feel like Jackie Lacey hasn't really done anything, in prosecuting cases for police killings and brutality. I know one of our reporters talked to a woman named Maria, who was celebrating the news of your win and the loss of Lacey. Let's hear what she has to say.
We want police who murder our citizens held accountable. It's not just about a skin tone. It's that we want the police held accountable just like anybody else who murders. Why is it because they have this certain job that they can murder somebody?
So what do you say to that? This is obviously this is about immunity. This is about Black Lives Matter protests. This is about, you know, the killings and the brutality against black people for sure. What do you say to her and so many other folks who feel like no one's listening?
Yeah, you know what? And I completely understand the frustration. The reality is that we in government, and certainly police and prosecutors, we have to be held accountable just like we hold other people accountable. And certainly if a police officer or a prosecutor commits a crime, they need to be held accountable for those crimes. I mean, there's a reality in our system, and that is that, you know, we have been plagued with systemic racism in our communities for generations, and certainly the criminal justice system has been part of that problem. And looking for ways to bring equity and, you know, the fair application of the law, you know, just fair and just prosecution at the end of the day, is critically important to the legitimacy of all of us. You know, it's actually good for police officers, it's good for prosecutors, it's good for all of us to make sure that the public feels that these governmental agencies are going to be working for them, and that when there is wrongdoing, that people are going to be held accountable. So I agree with that person 100%.
You're also a former police chief. You rose through the ranks of the LAPD. You worked under William Bratton. San Francisco Mayor London Breed supported your opponent, Jackie Lacey. You were the San Francisco DA. The progressives there say that you didn't prosecute police for shootings and use of force when you were the DA up there. Can we expect you to handle things different here in LA?
Yeah, you know, look, I mean, first of all, it is true that the mayor of San Francisco supported my opponent, just like the mayor, not only the LA mayor, but many other local mayors supported me and not my opponent. It's also true that the district attorney in San Francisco supported me, and several members of the board of supervisors endorsed me, and the head of the Democratic Party endorsed me at the time. So look, I mean, politics are politics. And just like a lot of the people here locally, in fact, most of Jackie Lacey's support here disappear, you know, and a lot of them actually came to me very early on and said, you know, we only endorse her because you were not here. And I'm going to park, you know, San Francisco politics in San Francisco. Now, the distinction between my opponent and myself when it comes to police killings is, number one, I never had a shooting that we adjudicated that involved somebody that was unarmed. You know, all the shootings that we have were people that were armed. And yet I came out publicly on a couple of cases and say, these shootings are lawful, but they were unnecessary. And then I was the only district attorney in the state to campaign publicly and lobby the legislators to refine or to re-engineer the law concerning police use of force, because I recognized that there was a big hole that goes to the point that this person that you play the recording of, you know, the lack of accountability that we're seeing where there were unnecessary killings occurring. We have a new law now, but in LA County, we've had many shootings of unarmed people on video that we see that clearly not only they were unnecessary, but even under the old law, would probably require a second look, which I have already committed to doing. And by the way, when I lobby statewide for a change in the law, I asked my opponent, Ms. Lacey, to join me, and she refused to do so. And we actually have the letters going back and forth. And this was way before I had any idea that I would be running for district attorney in L.A., much less getting elected. So it was not really a political call. It was a call to say, look, we have a wrong that needs to be corrected, and we as district attorneys should be the ones leading this. And frankly, you know, there are 58 counties in the state, and I was the only district attorney that went ahead and moved. And Lacey actually responded to my letter and said, we'll take it under consideration, and never did anything about it. So the difference is that we had unarmed shootings of unarmed people that I felt, I'm sorry, I did not have any shootings of unarmed people. There were armed people. And yet in some cases they were unnecessary, but unfortunately under the law at the time they were lawful. Here in LA County, we have multiple shootings of unarmed people that even under the old legislation should not have occurred. And she refused to hold people accountable. And frankly, she was so conflicted by the funding that she took for police unions and endorsements that I think it really clouded her judgment.
Are you going to pick up any of the cases that perhaps, you know, that she overlooked or is accused of overlooking or not prosecuting and reevaluating those cases?
Yeah, so I came out publicly actually, many weeks ago, and listed the first four cases that we would reopen. And that was after looking at dozens of cases. You know, we're not taking this lightly because it's also important to recognize that, you know, police officers are often put into very difficult scenarios and they, under a certain set of circumstances, you know, we give them authority to use deadly force. And when they use deadly force appropriately, they need to be supported as well. But there were cases that we looked at, and there are four that came out to the surface, and I think there will be others. But certainly we have announced four that we will be reopening to take a closer look, because at least on the early reviews of these cases, we, and I say we because we had a group of people, including a retired judge, former members of the U.S. Justice Department, that we agreed that those cases did not seem to be appropriate.
Because of COVID-19, DAs and public defenders are staring down the barrel of enormous caseloads, a lot of backlog. Do you have a plan to lessen caseloads in this department?
Absolutely. Look, I mean, I've always said that L.A. County prosecutes way too many cases. We have too many, especially low-level misdemeanor offenses that involving people that are mentally ill, people that have substance abuse problem. They should be diverted, and they should be diverted really early. And so we have, just traditionally under the normal process, there were a lot of cases that were inappropriately prosecuted. Now under COVID, it's really, it's almost like we're ignoring the dangers that in many cases we're incarcerating people and we're bringing people into courtrooms and in some cases almost putting them in potential threat of death. And that has to stop. You know, as an elected public official, my first obligation above all is to do no harm and is to protect our entire community. And part of that requires that we use, that we're thoughtful and that we are proportional. And when you're putting people in situations where they could end up dying or unfortunately spreading this horrible disease to someone else that may end up being gravely ill or death because of, you know, some low-level thing that should have been handled differently, I think is unconscionable. So I think that even before COVID, this county was prosecuting way too many cases. And by the way, I'm not talking about no accountability. I'm talking about how do you intervene? You know, when people are mentally ill and they have committed low-level offenses, really what we need to do is we need to provide mental health intervention. We need to provide other assistance. I'm going to be very intentional in working with the Office of Diversion and Reentry and other community partners in our county to make sure that we start becoming more thoughtful about the way that we use what is really the most expensive intervention in our criminal justice system, which is litigation, should be reserved only for serious cases.
Before you left, you lived in L.A. for a long, long time. You rose through the ranks of the LAPD to assistant chief under William Bratton, but you got no love from the police protectively. I mean, they gave a lot of money to support Jackie Lacey. That's some animosity there, and you've got to work with this department somehow, and all law enforcement officials, sheriff's department too. How do you do that with the folks who are charged with trying to fight crime?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to separate police unions from police departments and police officers. They're not always the same. They gave her $7 million, and it came, by the way, not just from local policing, but it came from policing all over the state, and there was a real clear reason for that. You know, police unions have sort of attached themselves to a way of doing business that has been shown not to work for many years. There are really monetary interests that are driven this. You know, the large size police department, more union fees, more money, more political power. Frankly, in many cases, I would say they have become peddlers of tragedy, because what often happens between police unions and prison guard unions is that they have sort of put a lock on the definition of public safety. Anybody that has come against them, they will immediately label them as soft on crime and go viciously attacking them. We had an assembly member recently that the prison guards union put his face and a silhouette with a target. This has to stop, right? First of all, public officials, and that includes law enforcement, we work for the people. It's not the other way around. And, you know, we have reached a level of, of expenditures when it comes to police and public safety that have outstripped almost every other public service. You know, we built 22 prisons in the last 30 years and one public university, and then we wonder why we have so many problems. We need to, we defunded education in the state. We defunded mental health. We need to start reallocating resources back into those areas that are going to make us a much better community. And by the way, I've had now many county chiefs of police have reached out and we're going to work together and we're going to work together professionally. I have spent my entire life in public safety, over 30 years of that. Before I was a DA for 9 years in policing, I am very committed to community safety, but I'm committed to doing it right.
You still have to work with these folks, though. I mean,
absolutely.
In your office,
and we are. That's what I'm saying. We're going to do so. I'm already in conversation with a lot of the leadership around the county.
George Gascon, just elected LA County's new district attorney. Mr. Gascon, congratulations again, and good luck to you, sir.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it. You take care.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Now, following up on election results in Orange County. The race for the presidency was finally called over the weekend, and a lot of folks here in Capital B Blue, California, took to the streets to celebrate, cheering when the results came in, shooting off fireworks, of course, dancing on cars. Now, a couple of years ago, that deep blue in California even reached Orange County in a Democratic wave that swept every OC House seat. But it's looking like that tide is going back out to sea for the Dems this time around. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is here to talk about what to look for in this week's KCRW Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
First things first, Joe Biden became the president-elect over the weekend. And how'd he do in Orange County?
He won. So that's going to be two presidential elections in a row where the Democratic candidate has won in Orange County. Remember, in 2016, there was national headlines made because Orange County, the place where Reagan said all the good Republicans go to die, had picked a Democrat as president for the first time since the FDR administration. Now, it ain't no thing. It's just how Orange County's going, blue.
And looking at the numbers, it wasn't even close for Biden. He won by 9 points in Orange County.
Yeah, that really shows just the disgust that people in Orange County, and not just Democrats, mind you, but also Republicans who might have voted Republican for the rest of the ticket, but in Trump, they just saw someone who they just could not do it.
But you touched on something there, Gustavo, which was down ballot. That was not the case. It wasn't a straight Democratic ballot. For many people in Orange County, they voted maybe at the top for blue, but then they went Republican. They went right back home when it came to these House races, because we have a couple of very close ones, right?
Yeah, well, it's interesting how it's the rest of the ballot is playing out right now in Orange County. So, of course, what also made national news in 2018 was how the House seats, all the congressional districts in Orange County, went blue for the first time ever. This time around, it's not going to happen. So up in northern Orange County, a race that we spent a lot of attention to was Gil Cisneros versus Young Kim. Young Kim, it seems she's a couple of thousand votes ahead of Gil Cisneros right now. So it seems like, and the odds are the returns are not going in Gil Hill's favorite, so it seems like Young's going to go to Congress. Also, she's Korean-American. Also Korean-American is current Orange County Supervisor Michelle Steele, who was facing off against Harley Ruda in the 48th Congressional District. This is Huntington Beach, Newport Beach, mostly the coast, a little bit inland, and she has a comfortable lead over Harley Ruda as well. That one is not as... Both of them are not really surprising in a way, because up in with Young Kim, it was super close last time around, so in this case, she just pushed a little bit ahead, and now she's going to win. In Michelle Steele's district, it's Huntington Beach. Michelle Steele, of course, on this program, we've talked a lot about how she doesn't think coronavirus is that big of a deal. Well, that's how Huntington Beach is. That gets you elected in Huntington Beach. And if you don't believe me, look at who Huntington Beach elected as their city council member, Tito Ortiz, the former Ultimate Fighter.
So aside from Biden winning in Orange County, was it a really bad night for Democrats in Orange County, or did they have some victories?
No. So what you're seeing, you know, is the continued liberal march in Orange County. So on the state Senate races, you have Josh Newman winning back his state Senate seat from a couple of years ago when he was recalled over Lingling Chang. And here's an upset. Dave Min, a professor at UCI Law, he beat John Morlach, who's a legend in Orange County politics. This is the man who in 1993 called the Orange County bankruptcy. From there, he became a supervisor, a state senator. So this is like the conservative line of Orange County. And he's going down in defeat by at least over 10,000 votes. And then even more importantly and more crucially on the local level. So the problem with the Democratic Party in Orange County forever was that they were not doing anything on the local levels. But now, according to the Orange County Register, Democrats have a majority of school board seats across Orange County, which is a huge, huge, huge opportunity. Think of it in Major League Baseball, like the minor league system. The school boards are the minor leagues. From there, they start leaping up into city council races and other races as well. So in a couple of years, you're going to see these school board races bear fruit, and you're going to see even more Democrats running for even bigger offices.
So orange went blue and then swung red, and now we're ending with purple. Is that about where we are, Gustavo?
Well, it's almost like a taco, because hello, I'm the author of Taco USA. So on the coast, yeah, of course, you have to go there. On the coast and then inland, so we're talking about Huntington Beach, Newport, whatever, then flipping over to like Villa Park, Yorba Linda, going down that way, it's red. But cutting right across Orange County, the ingredients, as it will, it's all blue. And it's quite remarkable going up from Buena Park all the way down even to South Orange County, Mission Viejo. I was shocked. You know, the stereotype that I always have on this program is that South OC is the last redoubt of Republican conservatism, but it's not. It doesn't seem to happen. At least it didn't in the presidential elections. And that's the thing with the Republican Party. Even though they might get those congressional districts, they're still not. Now they're fighting from behind because they see the proverbial writing on the wall, and it's blue.
So let me get this straight. The Republicans are the tortilla.
Tournament, yes. I would say this is, in this case, that Orange County tortilla probably wouldn't get past the second round into the Suave 16. Sorry, Orange County.
I think we've reached peak Gustavo. Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, with us for KCRW's Orange County Line. Gustavo, as always, thank you.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, a battery recycling plant has been contaminating an area in East LA for years. Now, the company that owns it wants to abandon it, but will it ever be cleaned up? The status report coming up tomorrow. We are online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us how you're feeling and subscribe to the podcast, won't you? Stay with KCRW throughout the day and night for the latest coverage, local, national reports, NPR news all throughout. Thanks to our team, Jenna Cagle, Angel Carreras, Sonia Geis, Amy Todd, Desmond Taylor, Phil Richards, Chuck P., Mario Saavedra, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl, all making the show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your ears and attention. Have a great night.